Thank you very much, my friend. And Don, right?
Yep.
A couple of comments on that. If you don't know the book, Values and Risk Assessment, you should. It's a Canadian classic and very often cited and will be for a very long time. When you get into new ventures, it's very wise if you trust your friends. So of the six expert panels, I got Conrad to chair a third of them, two of them. They're actually, the reports are well worth reading. My favorite of all, which I call the monkey panel, a panel on animal welfare issues, which has been extraordinarily influential. And the federal government wanted to decide what to do with its colony of macaque monkeys that used for medical research. I think it'll be a long time before I ever see this scene again at the press conference where we released the report, because there were animal welfare organizations, a lot of them based in Ottawa, who were very, very keenly interested in this issue and highly skeptical that a bunch of folks like Conrad and others could really do anything about these important issues about animal welfare. And then they looked at the report shortly before the press conference in which Conrad introduced the panel. And I don't expect ever to see that again, because at the end of that presentation, the audience broke out in spontaneous applause for the panel. They couldn't believe that a group of old fogies from academia and elsewhere could do something so important on so sensitive an issue. It was an extraordinary event. It does look like the government of Canada is going to fund this entity. The Prime Minister is apparently quite keen on it, which will mean that the Canadian Academies of Science will be have the capacity, will have 10 years of money in the first draw, capacity to do 5 of these reports a year on important and sensitive issues. So, it looks like that may happen by in the federal budget in February or March, which will be very interesting in terms of the task of setting it up. But anyway, these are really interesting ventures in which you can bring the intelligence and experience of very good people to bear on really very sensitive questions. And if you've never looked at the second of the report, Elements of Precaution on Genetically Modified Foods, you should look at that. It's also a world classic. I think there have been at least 10,000 hits on the Royal Society website to download that report. Although he got me into very serious trouble with that one, I have to say. I have hate mail from distinguished Canadian biologists about that report. And we have this procedure that the people who asked for it, which in this case were three departments of the Government of Canada, get to see it after it's printed, but a couple days before it's released, so that they know what to say when reporters come. And I get this midnight letter, supposed to be released on Monday. I get it like Friday at 10 p.m. from the Deputy Minister of the Department saying, this panel has made serious mistakes. I mean, well, they've ignored certain important things. I know these people. I said, did you give them these documents? Well, no, they should have known about them. That was the end of that. But it was an exercise, an attempt at intimidation that didn't work, and this panel report is also quite an extraordinary document. Well, I want to go on from the discussion, basically just to pose some questions. And for any of you who were not here last time, I mean, if there's any catching up to do, we will try to do that. But in a nutshell, the presentation that began it was to frame an issue that will be, for the people who are younger than I in the audience, will be without a doubt on the agenda of your lives very significantly, because these are events that will happen in the next 20 years, in which our capacity in science and technology to manipulate the genomes of living things will be advanced to an extraordinary extent. And I believe this is a type of knowledge that is much more faithful than any other type of knowledge that is based on modern science and technology, in which you have this sequence of things in which the 19th century was the century of chemistry, when the basis of industrial society was formed. The 20th century was a century of physics, starting with Einstein. We had the centennial this year, which in a technological sense led to extraordinary things, including nuclear energy. The 21st century is a century of biology and molecular biology, which is genetics. But that knowledge is of a different order qualitatively in terms of its social implications than chemistry or physics, because that knowledge goes to the very heart of the most basic concerns of human civilization since its origins. Every human civilization, largely through its religions, has had a creation story. It is a fundamental part of a species which seems impelled to seek meaning in us. And for most of human civilization, that has been grounded in religion, and every religion has a creation myth. That is a story which is fundamental to the entire enterprise of religion and society. It defines the basic nature of the human being, which is defined in terms of relation to a god or gods, and what it can hope for in terms of an earthly life and a life in the hereafter. It's a creation story which is the grounding of everything. Molecular biology gives us an alternative creation story. It says that all this came about through random mutation of an information system called DNA. And that, in principle, we can have an explanation of how we arose on Earth and all other living things as well, that is complete and requires no other addition. It is, in fact, a kind of story for which the famous line by the French scientist Laplace in the beginning of the 19th century gave to Napoleon, when Napoleon asked him for a little briefing on what you know about the world. And Laplace gave him a briefing, and Napoleon said, I didn't hear any mention of God in that story. And Laplace said to him, sir, I have no need of that hypothesis. That line will serve for the break that this makes in terms of now molecular biology and the alternative creation story. But it's so that is significant, and I want to come back to discuss with you why and how it is significant. But it is also at the same time equally significant for society, for some of the things that we've presented yesterday, because it opens up a capacity to manipulate aspects of the human being and all other beings, which is simply so far beyond anything we could have imagined before in terms of technological application, that it is, again, it's a qualitative change, not a quantitative one. It's a change in quality. So I want to just summarize in what respects I think it is this truly revolutionary technology, which goes to the heart of both the social compact in society and the religious compact of societies. In terms of summarizing where we got yesterday, Conrad had an important intervention, because I tried to think of things just to simplify and present in a clear fashion. The notion of a completion of the project of molecular biology, in which you would have the knowledge for humans and all other species of exactly how the genes work in each of them, so much so that you are capable of taking the genes, the set of which, and in humans, surprise the scientists, only 30,000, the set of which provides, in principle, a complete explanation of how this creature comes about. Complete and total, requiring no other form of explanation. Starting from the first moment of conception of a fertilized egg and of a single strand of DNA. From that point on, and leading down all the way to the construction of the most complex organ in nature, namely the human brain. We are within a few years, in fact, of finding out exactly how that happens. So there's an article from a few weeks ago in which they basically isolated 200 plus genes which seem to be important for the development of the brain. But we can modify that bit. You don't have to say, oh, we'll ever have this total knowledge. It doesn't really matter. That just, in my mind, enables you to think more clearly about the implications. We will have some set of knowledge about that. In the two dimensions I mentioned, the therapeutic and the cosmetic. The therapeutic meaning that the capacity to identify the sources of diseases of all kinds, whether they are genetic or purely genetic, and some diseases are purely genetic, single gene disorders, or the diseases that arise in the combination of the gene-environment interactions. And to alter genomes so that you can either abolish or modify these significantly. And the cosmetic applications on healthy people, the idea that these manipulations can make people who are otherwise healthy better. You can have more muscle mass, use the example in terms of bodily things, and changes in cognitive capacity or learning capacity, which are, we already know from studies with primates, monkeys, and chimps, have very important biochemistry pathways in the brain. Now, I can accept Conrad's reservation that there will be a lot there, a lot of uncertainty for a long time, and maybe some uncertainties that are never resolved. So what this means is that there is something less than 100% certainty that our intention will be fulfilled exactly as we hope. Another way of putting that will be that there will be some risk that you won't obtain your objective of either making this repair or making this improvement, or that there will be some unintended adverse consequence. But that often happens. That happens today with tried and true methodologies. It's exactly the same. You go in for surgery, and it can kill you, no matter how many times it's done. There's a certain risk. And there's a certain probability that there will be adverse things, that you're in the hospital for heart surgery and you come down with a serious infection because of a lot of serious infections are based on hospital-based organisms. So that's going to happen, and it will happen. But I think, nevertheless, that we will try to do this. So what will we try to do? In general, there will be, I believe, inevitably, and I think this is at least for the initial periods of time, inevitable, that there will be comprehensive modification of bodily traits, like muscles, all the processes that lead to obesity and so on, some of which have molecular switches. So bodily form and shape, even height, so height and weight, hair color, eye color, not a problem, really, in principle to do these things. So comprehensive modifications of bodily traits. Secondly, comprehensive modification of mental traits. Cognition, motivation, emotion, mood, learning. If you read carefully the Life in the Fast Lane paper, you can get the sense, the sections written by Mike Tushenko, microbiologist, we are some ways down that road already. Don't think this is all just starting. There's a lot that's already known. And if you doubt that, we'll have a session with Mike and he can fill you in on the details because he knows the technical and scientific literature. We are some way down to learning how to do those things. So comprehensive modification of bodily traits and mental traits. Third, comprehensive modifications of behavioral traits. Aggression, violence, fear, sociability, all of which have correlates in the biochemical pathways in the brain, some of which are very well known. And a lot more of which will be known a lot later. These are things which affect the interactions of people in society. Fourthly, for all of those changes I mentioned, bodily, mental, and behavioral, there are two choices on the menu. One is modifications of individuals in their own lifetimes, and the other is changes in the gametes or sex cells, germline modification, that those individuals will pass on or can pass on to their children. And in so doing, they can affect their children and, of course, their children's children, and thus enter the human gene pool as modifications that could possibly at some point have happened naturally, but will happen now by our intervention. And it is an important point here that it'll be mostly these individual modifications that matter. In fact, these modifications will not move very rapidly in human population because it's very slow for genetic modifications with a population this big. But the interesting thing is, I went back and reread the newspaper column you mentioned by Stephen Strauss, because I had it with me, basically talking about this. The interesting thing is, this is now a consequence of how big the human population is, but the key changes that happened when the population was very small, like 150,000 years ago, the origins of Homo sapiens, including one very important one in the gene called FOXP2, which is basically what enables us to speak, and is why apes and chimps can't speak because they don't have this modification. That hypothetically gave a huge competitive advantage to those human groups within which that developed, and against others, but there were only maybe 100,000 humans at that point, and so it then spread very rapidly as their competitors died out. So you have the option, though, of having these passed on at least to your children, giving advantages to your children and your children's children. And the fifth in this line, the possibility that this capacity to manipulate genomes will lead, in fact, to the end of the human community in the sense that you can get genetically isolated subpopulations who do not mate with each other. I mean, in principle, any two humans anywhere in the world can be reproductively fertile at the moment. Of course, there are certain obstacles that prevent this from happening 100%. But it will be very, very simple to actually modify cell surface receptors and so on to make it that we'll only be able to interbreed within certain communities in which certain traits have been passed down. So these are a whole set of possibilities, some of which are already on the horizon, some of which can be done. And for all of them, these changes could arise in two different forms, and I think they will arise in both. But in the first case, there would be the free personal choices of individuals or families. In other words, you'll go to your gene doctor and say, I'd like to do this. We're planning to have children, and I'd like to have that, that, and that. And say, okay. And this is what we'll do. We'll take some eggs from the mother, sperm from the father, We'll do some in vitro fertilization, fertilize a few cells, we'll scan it, see what you got, and then we'll do some manipulations and reimplant the fertilized egg back into the mother, and then you'll have it. So these, and these will be germline changes so that your children's children will have it too. And so this will be, and at this level, personal choices. And then, of course, there's the other prospect that societies may impose certain types of genetic manipulations, either on their own populations or parts of their own populations, or on the populations of foreign countries. And this might be to breed special types of fearless soldiers. We know the pathways in the brain, the amygdala, the old part of the brain, where the fear response is conditioned. We know, to just give you one example of how much we know so far, there's a gene called MAO, MAOAB, and it regulates the production of four of the most important neurotransmitters in the brain that sends messages back and forth between cells. And they discovered by genotyping a Belgian family that a point mutation in that gene, a single, you know, one of those single things we saw, the ACGT, a point mutation produces an individual in combination with abuse as a child with a more than 80% propensity for violent criminality. Single point mutation in that gene that regulates neurotransmitters. And I have, this is a publication in a scientific journal. It's because this Belgian family was rather inbred, and violent, inter-family violence, including spousal abuse and so on, was so pronounced in this family that they did this genotyping, and that's how they found this gene. There's an extreme form of aggression in the males in this family, which is what sent them looking for the gene in the first place. So play around with it. Maybe you'd want to produce that if you wanted to produce special types of soldiers. So there is that other possibility, although I think the first one will be more likely early on, namely that people will start to make choices when they have the opportunity. Okay. Now I just want to talk. What do you think we should make of this? In the paper you have, starting on page 44, there was, but especially the chart, which table one, which Mike prepared. There's a whole set of, on the left hand column, genomics technologies, specific ones. And genetics technologies. And then in right-hand column, there's sets of anticipated benefits, especially health benefits, and then on the right-hand columns, a set of what we call intrinsic and extrinsic risks. So we've tried to do a kind of catalog of that so far, and you can look at that. I just want to summarize these at the highest level of. So there are two categories that I'd like us to throw around. One is the socio-political, socio-economic risks. And the other is the ethical and religious dimension. On the socio-political and socio-economic, we have, for example, a whole set of risks that have to do with broad concepts of equity and justice, or what we might call distributional effects in society. Many of these things would produce advantages for some people that others would not have. In a competitive society, we have equity issues. The distribution of wealth, power, influence, and so on can be affected. If it is possible for people to manipulate both bodily and mental traits, and to do so in a way in which those traits might be passed down to their children. So distributional effects within society, equity and justice issues. Secondly, there are then distributional effects across societies in the world, because more advanced countries will have these first, richer countries rather than poorer countries, and they will hypothetically, they could have distributional effects in that respect. Thirdly, there's the issue of what we might call fundamental rights of the person as basically guaranteed in democratic and constitutional governments. And this, in the case of genetics, the right not to be changed. If it were imposed on someone against their will, but this is more of an ethical thing, your parents did it to you. So, and I want to see what other thing. These are very broad categories. They can be broken down into very much more simpler things, like the simple possession of information about your DNA, the privacy right, and so on, okay? Why is this important? Because each of us, there is some variation in human genome for each of us. I think it's 0.01% of that 3 billion base pairs. There's some variation. All of us are slightly different. Some of that variation is very important for inherited diseases, also for how we're, and it's important to pharmaceutical companies because we vary in how we respond to drugs. That's why there are side effect risks. With a full notion of the genome, those could be eliminated. You could predict those side effects and eliminate them by fine-tuning medicines. But that information, which is kind of a barcode, we could also at some point carry that code, and then who might be interested in it? Well, the insurance companies will be really interested in that, because they would be much able to predict who would get sick and who wouldn't, and that's discriminating their coverage and the coverage of risk. Employers would be really interested in that for much of the same reason, because healthcare costs, a country like the U.S., they are a significant factor for businesses, for those who have healthcare coverage in the U.S., which is basically only people who work for large institutions. And we already know that GM and Ford are almost getting uncompetitive in the world auto market, partly because of the health benefits they have to pay. So that could be dealt with in who you hire. And so when you break this down, there are quite specific kinds of things that come simply from the possession of the information about DNA, much less doing anything with it. So on the ethical and religious side, there is the risk, I think, of a fundamental rupture in the human community, with the possibility that you might produce genotypic isolates, subpopulations that could not reproduce with each other, and that this would be done deliberately. There are questions, fundamental questions, about the autonomy of the person. If certain changes are made in mental function, are we still responsible for what we do? Especially if there are unintended effects, as in the beginning it certainly would be. Third, the whole concept of designing life and how those who are created in this means might think about their parents who had done the creation, who had done the intervention to make them different. Fundamental questions about what you might think of yourself when you learned that you had been designed for a purpose, even if that would seem to be a noble purpose, like you'd be more successful, and your parents wanted you to be successful, that you were designed for a purpose that was chosen by someone else before you were born. So these are, in my mind, truly fundamental issues. It is true that societies have affected people's behavior traditionally, in many ways, in principle, some of these things may not be so different from societies. The best example, of course, is the caste system in India, where you are born into a caste, lower caste, for example, which have certain occupations restricted to it, like picking up dead bodies, the untouchables, which a Brahmin wouldn't get into, they're protected from. And you were born into this caste. You cannot leave it. Your children cannot leave it. Because you're also restricted in whom you can marry, so to maintain, perpetuate these castes. So it's a bit like, you know, it's not that it hasn't happened before. Most modern societies reject that, of course. It's not to say that it's never been done in traditional societies by these means. But we now have the prospect of having it done through genetics as well. So again, it's not that this is any of this is entirely new. It's just that it's raised to a new power, I think. So I want to, you know, I also asked finally the last time, if we thought these were really troublesome things, what do we think we can do about it, if anything? My concern is that this is a process that is, in a sense, not under any type of control or centralized choice, that it happens on a scientific level around the world, and we already have some evidence that certain things which are prohibited in some places are done in other places. Even differences among advanced countries, the kind of prohibitions on stem cell research that exist in the US do not exist in Britain, for example. So scientists can move if they want to. And also the prospect of things we saw with cloning, where people would say, well, I'll find some place to do this if you won't permit it here, or if you make it a criminal offense here. So what do we think we can do about this if we thought that there was something we ought to do about this? Or is it just going to happen and we'll have to try to pick up the pieces thereafter? So I would like to basically open this up and ask you really what you think about these issues, even as they touch your own self and your own choices that you might make as future parents, some of you, and things like that, when these opportunities are presented. I'll just, to conclude, go back to this cute thing that was in the article on cosmetic neurology, which this scientists end with, and I think some of you have left already. So he asks, I invite readers to consider their own views on the following questions. Would you take a medication with minimal side effects half an hour before Italian lessons if it meant that you could learn the language more quickly? And I mentioned last time, I really want to learn Italian, so my answer to that would be, oh yeah, I think I probably would. Would you give your child a medication with minimal side effects half an hour before piano lessons if it meant that they learned to play more expertly? Would you pay more for flights whose pilots were taking a medication that made them react better in emergencies? And if so, how much more would you pay? You know, maybe if anybody was on the Jetsco flight that the pilot screwed up in Calgary a week or a week and a half ago and ran off the runway, you might answer yes. It was quite a treat for the 78 passengers, apparently. Pilot made a mistake. Would you want residents to take medications after nights on call, medical residents, that would make them less likely to make mistakes in caring for patients of sleep deprivation, and so on? So, I mean, I think there's a good way of putting it. If these things were available, what would you do? And for yourself, or the children you might have? And does it matter? Is this just like any other thing we try to do to give ourselves and our children advantages? And now we can do it genetically. And it's just the next step. And the thing I handed out last time, there's a nice comment by a conservative commentator, Henry Miller at the Huber Institute, that says genetic enhancement is just like a nose job. Same thing. People try to have certain objectives when they get a nose job. And so this is just like having a genetic nose job. So what do you think? I've presented certainly some of the, at least by implication, the notion that I think that this is different, this is a new stage. in where it can go for us. It raises a prospect for me whether there is any human left or just something new. It's interesting, scientists play around. I have one example to show you how the modern molecular biology sort of pushes the traditional interface, especially in the older religious concept, where you have certain categories which are clear, and this comes up in the disputes about stem cell research and abortion. But science keeps pushing the categories, and ultimately what it does is, in effect, say to us, you know, what we're manipulating, it's just tissue. So here's the example. In Britain, British scientists, they're all looking for a way to evade the prohibitions on stem cell research, because they're dying to get at this stuff. They just want to do it. There's so many things they can do with stem cells, you know, are pluripotent. They'll make any type of cell you want when you've got them in a petri dish and you put them, you know, you want liver? Get some liver tissue, put some stem cells in, get more liver. I want some more nerve endings? Do the same thing.
A British scientist, just a couple of weeks ago, Team creates ethical embryos. Good news. They can't develop into humans, and therefore we can use them. British scientists say they have found a new way to trick nature into creating ethical embryos that could be used for human stem cell research without raising moral or religious objections. Because their peculiar genetics prevents them from growing into full-fledged human beings. So then they go on, before I get to the crucial point, well, what's going on here? So when I have that kind of question, I pick up the phone and call my microbiologist PhD, and like, what were they doing? So he gets a scientific article. If they found a way to trick an unfertilized cell into dividing by flooding it with calcium, and calcium predisposes the cell to divide. So a purely chemical means, chemically induced cell division. And it turns out this is actually a form of cloning, it's not the nuclear transfer cloning. You're just sort of goosing a cell with a flood of calcium. This is asexual reproduction. It turns out actually it's the way bees reproduce. So it's not unknown in nature. But they found a way to do this with a human cell. So it wasn't a human embryo. Okay? But it would lead the cell to divide and produce stem cells. That's what they're after. So here's the thing that I want you to reflect on. And this is in the words of this reporter who's got the science article and trying to come to terms, well, what it is. Remember I said, in the reporter's eyes, what they were, as she understood it, what they were up to, because their term was ethical embryos, to be used for human stem cell research without raising moral or religious objections, because their peculiar genetics prevents them from growing into full-fledged human beings. That cell that is goosed into dividing a couple of times to produce stem cells would not, if left to itself, unlike a clone, would not go on to develop a full-scale being. So here's the key thing. In describing, well, what is it that they have produced? What is it? What is this thing? Akin to activated cells that are neither fully human nor unhuman, alive but not in a traditional sense. The scientists say they aren't exactly sure what to call their tiny creations. And she quotes the scientist who was part of the team, quote, "We don't know whether we should be calling them embryos at this point. Maybe there needs to be a debate between ethicists and religious leaders to define them and debate what they really are." See?
we have, we're at the point, we could never have pushed the embryo so that you say, well, you don't even know what it is that you have in terms of traditional, is it human, not human? And the scientist says, well, I'm not really sure. You know, it's tissue. That's quite useful because it will give you a human stem cell and then you can play with it. So this is, I wanted to provoke you a bit, but this is where it's at. This is brand new leading edge stuff.
To keep the discussion